for everybody out there. Just know that more information has not made it harder on, or has not made it easier on buyers. It's made it harder. And that I believe that the future of sales is doing the homework, both the pros and the cons, leading with it. You build trust, you differentiate in the way that you sell, your cycles will speed up, your win rates will go up, and you'll make it really hard on your competitors to message against you.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, man, we're going to have a great discussion today. Now, for some of you who are heavy on the marketing side, you may say, well, why are we talking about this? I mean, because ultimately, if you're not supporting the sales activity within your organization, guess what? You have no organization, right? And so all of it has to fit into an overall ecosystem. And so we actually have somebody on the show today who's going to help us get a better understanding of why people do what they do, some things that really need to cause you to stop and rethink, and then help you bust some myths so that you can do a better job of showing value and converting sales. For many of you, I've shared this with this before. I'm a sales guy that was forced to do digital 20 plus years ago. Now, the thing is, for most organizations, what they are doing now is stuff that was outdated 5 years ago. So it's time to rethink. It's time to redo a lot of the things that we've been doing in order for us to just survive. I'm not just thrive, because we have Todd Capone, who's going to get in. We're going to have a great discussion. He is the author of The Transparent Sales Leader, also has authored another book called The Transparent Sale. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that caused him or molded his thinking. Todd, welcome.
Oh, man, this is going to be fun. Based on our little prep call, we're going to get nerdy, and I hope everybody's buckled up for it.
Most definitely. And before we get into that, if you could, just share a little bit about your background so people know where you're coming from.
Yeah, I have. I don't know how this happened, but I've always been a nerd for behavioral science. Like, I don't read current books. Like, I actually read the research because I like to come to my own conclusions. But I call myself, I was like a B+ sales rep. That always knew that leadership, coaching, and teaching was going to be my jam. I once quit my job and bought a sales training franchise, ran that into the ground. But coming out of it, I ended up getting elevated to leadership, seven-time sales leader who had a revelation and, like a lunatic, quit his job, wrote a book that I thought might suck, but people loved it. And it took on a life of its own. And like you said, I just released my second book, The Transparent Sales Leader. And now I just speak and teach on all things sales and sales leadership and revenue leadership.
You know, and oh gosh, we even are going to talk a little bit about some history that happened over 100 years ago that we really need to be mindful of. So make sure you actually stay in tune and listen, because that's going to be towards the end of our interview. But, you know, early in the book, I mean, you have a whole page that just, you know, it's kind of like one of those word pages that has different words on it. But you have sincerity, science, and structure. And you say that can transform sales results. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah. So I don't know about you, but or for anybody that's like got promoted into leadership at some point in their career, right? Like, as a salesperson, I was always supported by a structure and a process, right? Like, that was what you do. It was like the conveyor belt. And then all of a sudden I get promoted to leadership and like, woohoo, like the most exciting day of my life, right? Is being promoted to sales leadership. And then like 48 hours later, I realized, wait, where's my process? Where's my structure? I'm a dog chasing a car down the street. And every morning, I don't know which direction that car is going to go, right? It could be a personnel issue, a deal issue, a board meeting, a forecast call, whatever it happened to be. I was too much of a nerd for that. Like, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle the uncertainty and the lack of control. So 14 years ago, I created a structure for myself, and it became what we're going to talk about a little bit later, which is the 5 F's of building revenue capacity. But basically, it was a way to categorize all of my responsibilities as a revenue leader. Sales, marketing, doesn't matter. the five F's incorporate all of those things. And once I was able to internalize those, I could use them as my way to plan, strategize, communicate. When the bullets start flying, I always had that to fall back on, right? So that became the structure of leadership. Through my nerdery and research over the last 14 years, I've optimized each element for behavioral science and decision science and how we as human beings engage, prioritize, decide, make purchases, and then layered that all on a bed of transparency, which is we run behind people who don't pretend to be perfect, right? We don't run behind people who suck, but there's a balance in there. And so that's the structure of this thing is the five F's all optimized by science on a bed of transparency. And I believe that the future of revenue leadership is radical transparency. And that's kind of like the long answer to what you just asked.
Well, and as you're talking, I remind me of a conversation that I had just 2 days ago with somebody who took a brand new role with a startup. And they have, he said, we have this, you know, chief revenue officer that came from our parent company that essentially has funded this particular business unit. And this guy came in and he said, okay, you need to make sure that you're essentially making 50 touches a day. You need to send out messages, da, da, da. And I'm like, man, it just seems like it's the wrong thing to do. So here's what happened. That was the metric that he put out there. One of the people who is on their sales team, basically she just sent a digital message, you know, to all of these people who she was supposed to be following up on. And for her, her day was done. Yeah, good luck with
exactly.
That. What do you do about that?
Well, man, there's so many examples of that. Like that's one of those things. I just saw there was a research study released that said that like today to reach a new cold executive, it requires 18 touches. And then I see the comments under it going, oh crap, we're stopping at 8. We should add 10. I'm like, no, why don't you stand back and ask yourself, why is it taking 18? Why do our first 17 suck so badly that it takes that many, right? And the same thing goes in leadership. And it was something I used to do wrong. And it was this idea that like I would measure my team, you know, obviously by their results, but one of the things was what was called pipeline load, which is at all times, you better have 4X your quota in pipeline because we know we're only going to close 25% of that. And the reps are like, okay, Todd, I'm going to fill it with 4X of crap, right? And that's what would end up happening. Now, instead of going, hey, listen, 4X is the number because we closed 25. Why don't we as revenue leaders take a step back and go, why is it only 25%? Why are we so bad at qualification that we're wasting 75% of our time? Can we get better? And one of the things that I preach a lot is this idea that, you know, obviously the best thing is winning. Second best thing is losing quickly. And if you're a revenue leader or any kind of leader in your organization, one metric you should go run after right now is for the deals we lose, how long does it take to lose? And can we look at ways to shrink our time to loss? Because you only got one thing in your inventory that you can really turn into revenue. It's your time. And if every single opportunity you work has a cost associated, an opportunity cost, let's get smarter about that. And so, yeah, you saying that is one of those things. It's like, hey, we know it takes 50. And I'm like, ding, 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 here's 50, right? It's just, it's a dumb way to think, like take a step back and understand the why.
But, I'm sorry. I can't tell you how many times and this is what goes back into, and it was one of the questions I was going to ask about is, you know, rethinking and myths. I mean, throughout this book, and you just essentially just went through and hit some things that I think have been long held standards. Is people yeah. think, okay, well then how do I build a sequence that's going to, you know, take them throughout the entire year? Right. Because right. It's like, oh my God, it's like, you need to change the bait. You need to do things quite differently than you've been doing. You need a new system. It's not that, you know, I learned something from Kent Billingsley, who wrote a book called Entrepreneur to Millionaire. And I reference it quite a bit because Kent's one of those, much like you were just doing. It's like, what the heck are you thinking? It's like, no, don't even. And he talks about how, you know, it isn't a situation. Entrepreneurs and entrepreneur mindset, they don't look at something and say, oh, I can do it better. They look at it and say, oh, I can do it different. Right. So it's not that I create a better sequence. I need to rethink the entire process and system and our approach. you know, and then therefore not experience the fact that we just wasted 10 touches and opportunities. And oh, man, by the way, we probably burnt several bridges. And now people will never talk to us, right? It's just dumb thinking. But this is what we've always done. And this is sort of the long-held beliefs and standards. Now, that you say sales leaders need to rethink and that we must challenge. What are some of the others that come to mind?
And there's so many. There's one that jumps to mind based on what you just said. I grew up in a time of sales where there was still this old school leadership mentality, right? Which was kind of like, hey, you're lucky you've got a job, instead of like, hey, thanks for showing up again today. But like one of the words that I think is a petri dish for lies that I think is like, it's a dirty word in revenue leadership, and it's the word commit. If you're a revenue leader, a sales leader, and you're asking your sales individuals and your sales teams to provide a commitment, I am a believer that that is creating the wrong behavior. Because think about it. You're creating a commitment to something you truly can't commit to. If you are somebody who's walking into a quarter that's having to make a commitment whose pipeline doesn't look so good, what are they thinking? Well, of course I'm going to commit my quota. What am I, a lunatic? And then the people that have a massive pipeline, do you think they're going to commit to 3X their quota that quarter? No way. Like, hey, I don't want all the eyeballs on me. I'm not going to just commit my quota. I'm going to go 20% over that. Like, that's good, right? So we create this lie. And then we start committing to individual deals. Your rep has got a deal that he or she has committed to, and it starts to go south. Where do they go first when that deal starts to go south? Well, you want them to come to your leader, right? Immediately, the deal's in trouble. Well, as a leader, you're there to help them. But if I've committed that deal, I think twice about going to my leader first. I'm going to try to salvage it myself. And then when it does go off the rails, I'm going to blame the customer. And as a result, we lose slowly. We don't get good coaching quickly. And we lose for the same reason over and over again, because we create a culture where your reps are not freely admitting where they've made a mistake, where there was something that they should have seen that they didn't. And so a couple of things. Number one, erase the word commit from your vernacular, right? Because it is a petri dish for lies in your sales organization. But number two, and this is really counterintuitive, celebrate the losses to the point where one time we did a champagne toast for a rep who lost a big deal. And I know that sounds like lunacy, but what are we doing? We're celebrating them for the effort. They're already getting hit in the pocket in their quota, right? They're already getting punished, right? But celebrate it for the effort. But most importantly, celebrate it for the lessons that can be learned for everybody, so we can have a nice powwow so reps can go, hey, that deal looks like my deal. Crap. Maybe I should proactively do something about that. And if we're going to lose it, lose fast. We learned those lessons. It's not that the customer sucks. It's, hey, let's create a culture where losing is celebrated, and whoever's default, let's learn from those, right? So we don't lose for the same reasons over and over again. So like, that's one of them. The word commit, I think, is a filthy word in sales organizations.
Well, and as you're talking, I'm starting to think also as far as controllables, you know, there's some things that are just absolutely out of your control.
Yeah.
And you know, right. Could you have done anything about that? You know, would you do anything differently? I mean, I had one particular, sales opportunity that had a high, very high confidence level in it. But, you know, people are freaking out, you know, because of pending recessions and this, that, and the other. And we were going to do some work that had to do with a part of their business that they were getting ready to want to open up and want to get into. So it was kind of a new market scenario. And they're like, oh, we need to actually pull back and retrench. Could I have changed that? I mean, that's just overall organizational strategic decision. No, I could have done anything different in regards to that. Maybe do it, not even doing it for free would have gotten me the work.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. When you look at forecasts, a deal where the customer says yes, and they've got the contracts in front of them. Historically, we close 3 out of 4 of those. It means 1 out of 4 doesn't, right? And it could be for any reason that goes off the rail that's out of your control. But if you start to see trends because you create a culture where a rep isn't afraid to share like, hey, I screwed that up, or here's what's going on. Oh, we had three accounts in the last week that are worried about the economy. can we take that as a lesson learned and get ahead of that with our other ones? Right? Like, that's the key thing. And if there is a commitment made to those deals because the contract is on desk, the rep isn't going to solve for that. It is going to make excuses and go, it's out of my control, right? It's the economy. Okay, cool. Like, learn those lessons, get ahead of those so that we make sure that the rest of that pipeline isn't going to lose for the exact same reason, right? And that's the environment you're trying to create as a leader. And I just see too many, hey, you lost that deal. Well, you suck. And let's throw you on a table and throw some rocks at you until you learn your lesson. And then go back to your desk like Charlie Brown, just checking the mailbox on Valentine's Day, seeing he doesn't have any Valentines, and get back to it. Right? Like, that is old school and needs to go away.
I'm sorry, I'm sitting here laughing, but you, and it's because, you know, and one of the things you talk about is, you know, hitting revenue targets isn't the job, it's the outcome. And I think that's what you were explaining right there, correct?
Oh, exactly. We've got to create a culture, right? Where, first of all, we've got the structure so that we're seeing the holes before they become canyons, right? But it is also our responsibility to create a culture where your team, when they wake up in the morning, can't wait to get to it, right? They show up every day. They stay, they do their best. And then when they go to parties with their friends, they're talking about how great their job is, which speeds time to recruit, right? And keeps turnover low. That's your responsibility. And when you maximize all those things, guess what the output is? Maximum revenue, right? And it's not about pounding the deals through. It's about creating that culture and making sure that the road is smooth for your reps to be able to achieve what they can without having to hit the same roadblocks over and over again.
Well, and so a lot of this also feeds into, and this is part of the discussion we had before we started recording, into regards to what is marketing and digital marketing doing, and what are we doing from a prospecting area? What are we doing from a lead gen activity? And, you know, we talked a whole lot about, you know, how things have shifted, but yet we have a problem with so many people trying to cram things at the top of the funnel. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I was just telling you, I've been theorizing this idea that happened to me after a trip to Costco, right? The big warehouse shopping retailer, where, like, my daughter was having she's having a birthday party, 18th birthday party. And she's just like, hey, can you go to the store and, like, let's get a vegetable tray, get a fruit tray, and don't you forget the ranch dressing. Like, I think she would swim in it if she could. And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go to Costco, right? And you think about marketers and organizations that are constantly presenting their solutions as perfect, right? Like, we are 5 stars, we are fantastic, and everybody loves us. I pull into the parking lot of Costco and I have to get my card out. Like, I had to pay just to walk into the place. I find the ranch dressing and it's like, hey, you get one brand to select from, that's Hidden Valley Ranch. Oh, and here's almost a gallon, like, enjoy your bath. And then I turn to my right, like, hey, do you need some toothbrushes? Here's a half dozen. Mayo? Like, there's a lifeguard attached to it. And then, like, after you check out, there's a woman at the door checking your receipt to make sure you didn't steal anything. Costco is the number 2 retailer in the US behind Walmart with an almost 96% renewal rate on those subscriptions. And the experience is like, whoa. I just think there's an old school way that many B2B marketers and sales professionals, I was a chief revenue officer in my last role, where we were all about, let's fill that top of funnel. Like, let's just pack as much through it. And the more we put in the top, the more will come out the bottom. I think the future of the revenue funnel needs to be more like a cylinder, where we get really smart about the way we brand our organizations. Quit branding our organization as being perfect, because ironically, you're actually slowing the brain's ability to make a decision. You probably lose slower, and you probably lose to the status quo or no decision more often. And brand the things you give up to be great at your core, right? IKEA, Costco, Southwest Airlines, Progressive Insurance. The list of B2C retailers is really long. And oh, those happen to be brands that are at the top of their charts in their verticals. I don't see enough B2B organizations doing that. It's a little counterintuitive and it requires to step out on a limb a little bit, but brand what you give up to be great at your core, and your whole organization is going to be more efficient, and you will build trust. And gosh, we require trust to be able to make a decision, right? That's how you do it.
Yeah. Many counterintuitive things there. I mean, but everybody's telling us we're supposed to be doing that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're talking about, if we stop and reflect and think, inherently, if we're doing the same thing as everyone else, what is that called? Average.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the data about the 18 touches, right? It takes on average 18. Well, all right, let's be average. Like, it's crazy. Exactly.
But wait a minute. How come our results aren't extraordinary? Because you're average.
Exactly. You just proved it.
Okay. So, and I think you hit on, and we're talking about, some of the findings for you that you said that kind of changed your life. There were two data points.
Yeah.
A research study that was done at Northwestern University. Explain that.
I was the chief revenue officer of a company called Power Reviews in Chicago. Believe it or not, we were in the review space with a name like that. Who knew? But we worked with Northwestern to do a study that was looking at a website, right? And how consumers interact when a website is acting as the salesperson. And those results, there's three data points, two of which changed my life. And because of the application, not only to when a website's acting as a salesperson, but when a human being is. And here's the three. The one that didn't change my life. We all read reviews today, right? You're buying something you haven't bought before that's of medium to high consideration, like not a, you know, pack of gum, but something that matters. We all read reviews. Got it. But the two that changed my life. Number one, 85% of us skip the 5-star reviews and go right to the negatives, right? So when we're buying something we haven't bought before, we pass by the fives and go right to the 4s, 3s, 2s, and 1s. And the last data point was that a product, and this is across all product categories, some skew higher, some skew lower, but on a 5-star scale, a product that's got an average review score between a 4.2 and a 4.5, that's optimal for purchase conversion, meaning a product that's got a negative review right under it. Hey, this product sucks. Oh, great. I'm going to buy it now. You know, there's this company you may have heard of. They're called Amazon. You should look them up. Like Amazon back in 1995 was the first company to really embrace this idea of, hey, buy our stuff, give us feedback, whether you love it or you hate it, we're going to put it right under it. They seem to have done pretty well the last time I checked, but it's this idea that we subconsciously know that perfection doesn't exist. And we need the negative to be able to predict. We, as human beings, are prediction machines. We don't buy when we're convinced, or if we do, we're pissed about it a few hours later. We buy when we can predict, and we need that negative. And so that was the revelation that I had, that, listen, that's when a website's acting as a salesperson. My whole team is presenting our solutions as being perfect, and our marketing organization, everything is case studies about like the greatest thing ever. And as a result, we actually make it harder for our customers to decide.
Well, and even what you're talking about right there, when you start looking at just overall human interactions, we're always on guard and we're searching for what might kill us. I mean, it goes back to, everybody talks about the reptilian brain. And that's part of what the review, you know, process does as well, is we look for the stuff that might kill us and eat us and cause us to, you know, some remorse and that and the other. So that's why we do the negative review thing. So we have to think about that when we're interacting with someone, you know, whether it's, you know, in a virtual sales or even a direct sales type of environment, is to know that it can't be all glory and giggles.
Exactly. And there's a couple of ways to think about it. You know, the first time that I tried it, I went into, it was a big retailer up in New York, and they were like very New York in the best way possible. So don't take offense, but they were like right at me. There was no small talk. They're like, Todd, we're looking at you. We're looking at your competitor. How are you better? I felt the eyes of the room on me. And I was like, hey, I know this sounds crazy, but can I start with how they're better than us? Because they just released something that not only do we not have, but it's not even on our roadmap. And if that's going to be an important consideration here, maybe it helps me save time and investment of having my whole team focus on this, but you're issuing an RFP. Your team doesn't want to write them. They don't even want to read them, right? So let's go through that. The whole demeanor of the room shifted. I shared it. It was something that they didn't end up caring about, which was a win. But even if they did care about it and we lost quickly, that would have been a win too. They ended up not issuing the RFP. We didn't have to fly up. And they made the decision 10 days later instead of what would have been a 6-month sales process. And I was like, holy crap, this is amazing. Now people hear this and they're like, wow, Todd, you are bold. Like, that's a bold strategy. I would argue it's bold not to. And here's why. Would you prefer that they find out now or they find out after you've invested 4 months into this opportunity? Would you prefer that they find out from you or they find out from your competitor where you've just lost the ability to control the message, right? I just think that there's that, like, that was really where the magic started to happen. The other piece I'll tell you, Jim, is, like, again, I'm a nerd for sales history too. We hear this mantra all the time, and you scroll through LinkedIn and it says, you know, buyers know more nowadays, right? You hear that quote all the time. Buyers know more nowadays. Would you be surprised to hear that that's actually a quote from Thomas Herbert Russell's 1912 book, Salesmanship, right? That they were worried about the proliferation of marketing and advertising eroding the necessity of the sales profession, and we flourished, right? Fast forward, 2015, Forrester was reporting that a million B2B sales jobs would go away by 2020 because of buyers know more nowadays and the rise of e-commerce. They actually said that hundreds of thousands of college graduates wouldn't enter the sales profession either. And it flourished for everybody out there. Just know that more information has not made it harder on, or has not made it easier on buyers. It's made it harder. And that I believe that the future of sales is doing the homework, both the pros and the cons, leading with it. You build trust, you differentiate in the way that you sell, your cycles will speed up, your win rates will go up, and you'll make it really hard on your competitors to message against you.
Okay, gang, that's all we need to know. Interview's over. No. You just hit on, oh my gosh. You know, there was a study that came out that said more information actually adds 18% to decision angst and drag, right? So yeah. We have this mental load that exists, and oftentimes more information, you know, leads to that no decision, you know, like you were talking about. But yet again, from a marketing side, we're saying, hey, make all this stuff, do this, any other, send this, do that. And it's like, no,
it's not helping.
No, I mean, it's killing your opportunity.
Exactly.
Creating your opportunity. You know, and you talked about that, you know, it being a bold move not to. I mean, to me, it's like a bonehead move not to.
Yeah, you would think so, but we're all afraid to do it. Cause like, what if we lose? Well, that's great, right? But it requires leadership to embrace that idea too. And that's part of the reason, like, as I'm talking to salespeople, they're like, well, I'm gonna get in trouble. You're gonna get in trouble for telling the truth, right? Arthur Dunn, 1919, in his book, Scientific Selling and Advertising, he's got a quote in it that is my favorite sales quote of all time. If the truth won't sell it, don't sell it, right? Like, I just love that. It's like up on my whiteboard at home. It's like, that's the mantra we should be doing. Lead with the truth, sell the truth. And when you do, you will build trust. And even those deals you'll lose, you'll find that people come back around to you, right? They'll refer you because you will differentiate in the way that you sell. I'm telling you, there's no magic bullet in sales and marketing, but the truth happens to be pretty close.
Pretty darn close. Okay. So obviously all these things kind of lead into, you know, the importance from a sales leadership perspective. I want to keep on continuing to move because you talk about, and even the book is transparent, but a lot of people get confused. And I think we need to really point out and separate and understand the difference between authentic leadership and transparent leadership. What is the difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that comes up all the time. Like, as I talk about this, people are like, yeah, I'm authentic. Like, all right, cool. But that's a separate category. Like, what if you're an authentic jerk, right? Authenticity is about bringing your true self to the table, right? And as a leader, I actually argue that that could get you in trouble. Right. Because I've seen authentic leaders that polarize their teams by embracing things, you know, that are off the rails, right? Embracing lifestyles and political views and all of that kind of stuff that can actually get you in trouble. That's authenticity, right? And I mean, be a human being, right? As a salesperson, there's a quote by Dr. Frank Crane back in the 1910s. And he says, like, be a human being. Otherwise, your company would have just sent a catalog, right? So that's authenticity. Transparency is about playing your cards face up, right? Here's what I know. Here's what I don't know. Here's what I'm great at. Here's what I could use some help with. And I believe that we don't run behind leaders that pretend to be perfect, right? There are instances where we do, but we are most likely to run behind people that are aware of those things and are embracing them And in our organizations, the same thing, especially as we're in this period of economic uncertainty right now. And I'll share one crazy example for you. Transparency. When you think about economic uncertainty, I'm going to compare it to Japanese death row inmates for a second, if you'll buckle up. You know, if you get assigned to death row in Japan, right? So you're an inmate there. You know, they don't tell the inmates when it's going to happen. So they go to bed at night thinking, is tomorrow going to be the day? Back in 2021, they actually got their lawyers together, filed a class action lawsuit against the Japanese government, claiming that that practice was inhumane, right? Of all the stuff, the uncertainty was inhumane. Let's take that back to the world of uncertainty that we face right now from a macroeconomic perspective. I still see leaders that are just pretending like everything's cool. And then all of a sudden, one morning, they're like, hey, riff, right? Time to lay off 20% of you. And as a result, not only those people had been going to bed like Japanese death row inmates, but now all of their friends that heard about it are doing the same thing. And when you don't sleep well, you don't perform well, you're not as creative, your IQ goes down. So that's an example of timely transparency is right now, if you haven't already, make sure that you're embracing what's certain and sharing that, but also embrace what you don't know and creating regular intervals by which you will update the team so that they can know when stuff is going to happen, right? Like that's transparency. Authenticity is another silo that you just got to be careful with.
Okay. So in order to get ourselves moving in the right direction and have be more effective, you developed the 5F framework.
Yes.
So if you could, please explain and go through the 5F framework.
Yeah. And I'll try to make it quick because, you know, I'm well caffeinated. I can talk. But so here's the thing. Like we talked about at the beginning, you as a revenue leader can take every responsibility you have and layer it into one of five categories. And once you know those five and internalize them, you've always got, like literally as soon as you get done listening to this, you could spend 20 minutes and create a 30, 60, 90-day plan for yourself. And you never have to like Google or ask your friends, anybody have a good template for a 30, 60, 90-day plan? Like we've all heard that a billion times. So, and I'm kind of too dumb to not have made it alliterative. So they all start with the letter F, right? That was an easy way for me to remember. So as a revenue leader, your first and ongoing, always on responsibility is focus. And focus means thinking about your team. When they wake up in the morning, are they working on the right opportunities, the right verticals, the right company sizes, the right prerequisites? Like, are they spending their time focused on the right opportunities, the right people within those opportunities, and the right prerequisites if there's certain dynamics that need to exist for those accounts to make for good long-term customers for you? So focus.
Okay. And I'm going to stop you right there because in the book, in that particular section and segment, you talk about ICP.
Yes.
Now, it doesn't matter if you're a marketer or a salesperson. You need to know what ICP means and how it differentiates from just say an overall market opportunity.
Yeah.
I have been part of roundtables with sales and revenue leaders for the past couple of years, several thousand members that are part of the group that we run. More information is at peerroundtables.com if you want more information on that. But the percentage of people when we talk about ICP that ask me, what is an ICP? I'm like, you got to be kidding. But I think you need to explain what is an ICP.
Well, yeah. And I actually, there's ICP, and then I like to take it a step further because you just gain so much more confidence and momentum. But ICP means your ideal customer profile, right? So if you had a magic wand and you could bring in any customer on earth, who's going to be ideal? What is their makeup? The firmographics, right? Which is company size, and maybe it's the vertical and it's the geography. The demographics, meaning the individuals, their titles, their levels, their dynamics to be able to mobilize change. The prerequisites, meaning could be you need a number of users, you need a structure, you need enough number of stores, whatever it is, like that ideal customer profile you use to identify our focus from marketing and selling, you know, opportunities. Now, I like to go take it a step further, though, and go like, that's ideal. And a lot of companies do identify that, which is great. but then they go and cast a super wide net anyway, right? Because I'm like, that's ideal. And like the comparison I make is kind of a weak one in the book, but it's like, if you're thirsty, the ideal way is to get a glass of water. But I could go jump in a lake. I could go, you know, into a pool. I could have somebody spray me with a hose. And that's what we do, right? Now, I'm a believer in something called extreme firmographic focus, which I know sounds a bit counterintuitive too, but especially as things get tight. What we did in 2008 is we had closed a deal with an aerospace company, but we were casting a wide net to anybody who manufactures anything. And my CEO and I sat down and we were like, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we get the team to focus on aerospace and defense companies? And we'll do a short sprint around that. There's a consultant that knows that space. We'll bring in, he'll teach us everything about it, right? We'll bring in that customer because they want to see us be successful. We'll arm everybody to be able to speak the lingo and to be able to walk into any executive of any aerospace defense company. And instead of selling something and making them smarter about us, we can make them smarter about themselves and their own business. And so we created these sprints where we did that. And the next thing you know, during the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, we grew 400% year over year. We closed Boeing and Gulfstream and Cessna. Then we went slowly out. So start with the ICP, but I believe in the sprints tightly and vertically, because as it turns out, confidence is contagious. And if you're a salesperson whose responsibility is to talk about how great you are all day long, you're not going to do as well as if you can go into these opportunities and teach the buyer how great they can be. Oh, and happen to be enabled by what you provide.
Yeah, to me, that's kind of like the irony that I see all the time. It's like, oh, yes, we're very customer centric. And a whole debate, by the way, let me tell you about me in the process.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's so many ways that we've systemically within organizations created the anti-buyer centrism. Right. Like, and that's one of them. You know, another one that we can talk about in a minute when we get through the F's is even the way that we think about sales process and forecasting, but I'll hold on to that one for a minute.
Okay. So we have focus and then go to field.
Right. So field, maybe it was a forced fit with the word, but I think about it as I have a responsibility initially and ongoing to build the team that will take the field every day, whatever that field is. So the right people, the right experience in the right places with the right tools and the right resources, right? Tools, meaning maybe it's the tech stack or whatever, the right resources could be support, operations, enablement, training, like whatever it happens to be. Your second responsibility is to build a field to support the focus. And I believe it's not the other way around, right? Establish your focus, build a field and the tools and resources to support that focus. So that's number two. Number three is to the fundamentals. You as a revenue leader have a responsibility to make sure your team gets the right things right consistently. Messaging, positioning, prospecting, qualifying, discovery, demo, proposal, negotiate. That's part of your responsibility. Your fourth responsibility, probably no surprise, is to the forecast. You as a revenue leader need to be able to predict the future, right? And that's in terms, it could be the forecast itself, but it also encompasses the KPIs and the metrics that you use to be proactive versus reactive. And then the fifth F, which is arguably the cheesiest, but most important, is to fun. And I don't mean fun like, yay, you know, cotton candy and lollipops. I mean, fun is about creating a culture where your team is intrinsically inspired to show up every day, stay, do their best, and advocate for you and your organization. Those five, right? Focus, build a field to support that focus, make sure that field gets the fundamentals right all the time, establish a forecast so you can predict the future, and then encompass all of that by fun, which is the culture of intrinsic inspiration.
And now I also love, you had talked about interviewing for a particular role.
Yeah.
And there were, I don't know, just say 20 candidates. I can't remember exactly.
There's 13. Yeah.
13. Okay. 13 candidates that were going after this particular position. And you had received feedback in regards to, like, you were the only one that had a framework and a system in place in regards to all of those candidates. Tell me a little about that story.
Well, yeah, it was just this idea that, like, once you, anybody listening to this, you internalize the five F's, you're going to sound smarter than everybody else too, like 98% of them. Like, I needed all the help I could get, clearly. But, you know, going into that interview, it was just, you know, everybody that was a part of the interviewing committee was asking me, like, hey, how do you think about leadership and like, what would you do? And I'm like, well, here's the way I think about it, right? The first thing is we got to figure out our focus and make sure that we're optimizing our time. Oh, and by the way, it's called the 5S, right? Like I start with that. And then the second one is to build a field to support that focus. The third one is to make sure they're getting the fundamentals right. And I'm a nerd for those. And then we're going to forecast and create metrics so that we can predict the future. And we're going to encompass all of that by a culture where this team's going to want to run through a brick wall for each other and this organization. And they're like, what? Right? Like I got an offer that afternoon. And I was like some of these other 13, I knew like one guy was a guy that was, I really looked up to. And they had told me afterwards, they were like, hey, you're the only one that just off the top of their head had a structure to where they're thinking about this. All the other ones are, you know, fluffy, like this is the way I think about leadership, authenticity or whatever it happens to be. And like walking in with a structure is going to make you sound real smart too.
Well, the reality is that we all operate in some sort of system. And, yes. And if we can't convey that system to other people, it goes back to where we kind of started yes. in regards to that expectation setting and right? So that was very powerful. And I loved that you shared that story. Okay. So, and all of this, I mean, even when you were starting to talk about that, you start thinking, like I said in the book, you've mentioned rethinking. You talk about myth busting and things. Yes. Like, we've hit several of these things, but as we've gone through this discussion, is there another one that stands out that you want to share?
Yeah, let me go back to that forecast comment. And this is the funny thing for me, that every organization, I actually just did a keynote for a conference yesterday on rethinking buyer centrism. Because every company I talk to, they're like, yeah, we're buyer centric. But then if you take a look at their systems and processes, they're not. They're actually creating endorphin rushes around what sellers are doing. And here's the example, and I'll take you back to 1992. Glengarry Glen Ross, right? And like watch, you know, Blake from Mitch and Murray, Alec Baldwin gives this berating speech to these reps that last time I watched it, I think I cried myself to sleep afterwards. It's pretty brutal, but there is one thing he got right. And it was AIDA, right? So he's got AIDA on the board. Let's go back to 1898. Elias St. Elmo Lewis first theorized that all buyers go through four steps on their buying journey. Right? A, meaning attention. They're paying attention to you. I is interest. They've developed an interest in what you have to provide. D, desire. Baldwin calls that decision. He got that one wrong. But desire, meaning we generate a desire for that product or solution. And then A is action. We're ready to take action. We're ready to sign. That became the foundation for every sales process in every forecasting methodology, at least through the 1940s that I can find. To the point where in 1924, Elmer Ellsworth Lewis wrote in his book that, hey, I'm not going to talk about AIDA because every philosopher knows that's the process. Now let's fast forward to 1993 with Siebel, the release of that CRM, and then Salesforce in 99 and HubSpot. Out of the box, their forecasting stages, what are they? Qualification, discovery, demonstration, proposal, close, right? All seller-based activities, every sales process, what the seller should be doing along the conveyor belt. We say we're buyer-centric, but our systems and processes are creating endorphins for salespeople that are all based on seller activities. Now, in my last role, what we started with is I created a sales process that was buyer-centric, right? It wasn't AIDA. You don't hear anybody talk about AIDA when everybody did last back then. But it was the idea of we all basically go through that process. The way I think about it, and I'm not the one that came up with this, is we as human beings, when we're going to make a purchase, we go through three steps, right? Why change? Like, why is our status quo worth changing? Why you? So why that solution versus another? And then why now? And I'll argue the order of that with anybody all day long if they'd like. But we started to layer that. Our forecast immediately became more accurate. But second of all, the endorphin rush that our reps got was from recognizing buyer behavior instead of going through a conveyor belt of seller activity. And as a result, our relationships were stronger. We were more buyer focused. And as a result, customers stayed, they buy more, and they advocated. So that's another one of those things that look at your sales process. You don't have to throw out your stages, but I would layer at least on top some kind of buyer centrism and make that the basis of forecasting. Because who knew that we could get better at predicting when a buyer will buy based on what they're doing versus what we're doing. Like, surprise, surprise.
But hey, we're buyer centric, or we're exactly centric and buyer centric. Okay. You also in the book talk about some things that you use the word fundamentals, fundamentally that we must get right. What are they?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all the basics, right? And like, when I think about this from a sales leadership perspective, what do the salespeople have to do, right? Like, you got to make sure that they're good at prospecting and their messaging is right. It's something I had heard from a guy named Tim Reister at Corporate Visions, where he said, the minute that words are coming out of the mouth of your salespeople, is that's the success or failure of the whole organization, right? You can build great products, but once the words come out of the rep, it's the success or failure. You got to make sure you're getting those things right. I look at it and, you know, the way that you're demonstrating, the way that you're doing qualification and discovery, the way that you're doing negotiating, the way that you're doing your formal presentation choreography, the way that you execute strategy and the handoff process to the people that need to make what they just bought a reality, right? Those are the fundamentals. And you've got a responsibility, at least at the simplest level, to make sure that your reps are consistent. And one quick example on the messaging and positioning. As a CRO, and like, we had created an environment where the reps felt okay screwing up, right? Like, that was part of celebrating the losses. Like, I would ask five reps, like, hey, if you went to a party and somebody asked you, what do we do? Like, how would you explain it in a way that's not so high level that they're like, oh, you sell software. All right, great. But not so nerdy that they would need a propeller to understand, like on their hat to understand it. And the five would list them off, and like, three of them were great. One of them was pretty good. And then one of them, I didn't even know afterwards I worked at the same company. That's part of our responsibility as a leader, is to make sure that we're consistent and that our messaging and like that, that's a place to start.
Okay. So we have myths, we busting that we have to do. You have a whole lot of, you know, information, quite frankly, that's 100 years old that we keep trying to execute that should have stayed, you know, been jettisoned 50 years ago.
Yeah.
A lot of perpetuation of bad behavior going on. But then to close the book, you talk about the great resignation and a bunch of learnings from that. And you talked about that we can actually take these learnings and apply them in a lot of different ways. So if you can, help us understand that a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not up for like patting myself on the back, but I predicted the great resignation. And then I predicted this like sales purge that's kind of happening too. And to your point, it's historically as a profession, as an economy, we step on the same rake over and over again, right? Like we just keep seeing it. We keep pretending like, oh, this is so special. But the great resignation to me was a case study in behavioral science. It's so interesting to me. And like the weird analogy that I make is, remember the day when, I don't know for your listeners, if they still have cable boxes that are wired in their houses. But you know, there was a time where we had like five of them across our house. They're wired in. The kids have recorded their favorite shows on it, their favorite episodes. And so as the provider would raise their prices every year, we would just eat it, right? Because there's a physical cost to change. Like, we'd have to put a satellite dish in and rewire from the roof. And the kids are going to lose, like, and there's an emotional cost. Like, the kids would lose all their favorite shows. Well, you fast forward, now we're all streaming, right? There's just like smart TVs or a little Roku device that you can just plug in. It's all easy. Don't need anything. And so that the physical cost of changing providers is gone. The emotional cost is gone because now you subscribed and you get every episode, not just their favorites. And as a result, as soon as, like, I think it was DirecTV announced they're raising our monthly rate by $9.99 a month, within 20 minutes, we unplugged and plugged into YouTube TV. Right? No physical cost, no emotional cost, 20 minutes. Now, let's take that to what had happened in the world post-COVID. The exact same thing happened, right? We all went home. And as a result, changing jobs in a remote environment meant no physical cost of changing jobs anymore, right? You still walk into your home. Maybe you get a new laptop and they send you some logoed socks or something. And the emotional cost disappeared because you never really met any of these people. Like, you can't replicate the relationships and the best friends you build by actually being in the trenches with other people versus doing a Zoom happy hour on Thursday nights. And we're going to do dress up this week. Like, all right, cool. Right. So as a result, physical cost gone, emotional cost gone, So every little trigger would just cause reps to go boink, boink, right? Like raise quota, territory shrunk. I just lost a big deal and I don't have anything to back it up. Oh, I was talking to a buddy who's making a ton of money at a place that is hiring and he's having a blast. I'm going. And so you could just see that those mechanisms that used to keep us are gone. Yet we as leaders did the same things we always did, just did them remote. And so that's kind of that whole prediction about the great resignation was, hey, listen, we've just got to be mindful that the environment has changed. And I'll leave you with one last piece here. And I was just listening to an episode of your podcast where the individual, I don't remember his name, but he was talking about purpose. That was the missing link, right? That we as sales leaders, revenue leaders, if your team wakes up every morning thinking that their purpose, their mission, their impact at work is to their quota, there's no physical or emotional cost. If they wake up every morning thinking that the purpose of their work is to make an impact on the company, their customers, and their customers' customers, and they care about that, make their work mean something, that the old axiom that sales reps are coin operated is right if you're doing it wrong. That we've got to create environments where your reps show up every day intrinsically inspired to do the work and the variable compensation becomes the reward for doing that work they love instead of the reason they do it. And I believe that mission, purpose, impact, aim of your work is the element that is specific to you and your company. And if your reps buy into it, the rest is magic.
You know, as you're saying that, I hear, you know, I mentioned about meeting with a lot of those sales and revenue leaders and have for the past couple of years, and, you know, and a lot of them will talk about, hey, it's hard to find good salespeople, hard to find good salespeople. And to me, what you just said is the reality is if it is that difficult for you, it's because your mindset and your method and all of that is wrong. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Yes.
Right. And until you fix that, you're still going to be saying, gosh, it's so hard to find salespeople.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's your wake up call. Your wake up call should be able to say, we got something messed up here. Right.
Right.
And again, I want to reemphasize, it's many of us tinker. Hey, all we got to do is make this little adjustment and do this, that, and the other. And you know, therefore it should fix the problem. Most systems that we're using that are affecting your sales, your lead, your velocity. I mean, all of that is because it's the wrong system, not a broken one.
Exactly.
Man, I'll tell you, this is an awesome discussion. I've had a fun time. I hope everybody else has listening. Todd Capone, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Well, it's pretty easy. Just the old Google machine, but the best place is toddcapone.com, where there's all kinds of free resources. I do a sales history podcast that links in there where I just monologue on a different topic from 100 years ago. If anybody's to that level of nerd, that's just a hobby. But you can connect or follow with along on LinkedIn. I share a lot of my nonsense there. And if you connect, let me know where you heard me. And yeah, I would love to be a resource for you and the team if it makes sense.
Todd Capone, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom. And we wish you the very best.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.